Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. And on today's show, we bring you Elaine Pagliaro of the esteemed Henry C. Lee Institute in West Haven, Connecticut, to talk about many different topics, DNA analysis, forensic science, and many other issues. And I want to say welcome to both Delilah and to Elaine. How are you, ladies?
Hi, thanks for asking me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. How's everything in South Carolina, Delilah?
It's been a beautiful day. I know you don't want to hear that, but the sun is shining, the sky is blue, and it's been beautiful.
Well, we're snowed in, as you know. We're in a state of emergency, but things are rosy on the radio, as you know. And it's always rosy on the radio because we're doing such important work with very good guests such as Elaine. Let me just give you a real thumbnail sketch because Elaine has such stellar credentials that I don't know where to start. She she is on the staff of Henry Lee Institute of Forensic Science. She was with the Connecticut Department of Public Safety for many, many years, and almost 30 years. And she also is an expert qualified to be a witness in the area of forensic biochemistry, DNA analysis, hair examination, crime scene reconstruction. She's also a member of the bar, and she's also an expert on sexual assault as well, has written books, has written journal articles with regard to best practices for forensic nursing. She's completed a book most recently with Dr. Henry Lee, entitled The Real World of Forensic Science. So that's just a little bit of Elaine, and I have to say it was a pleasure to meet her last summer. She was very down earth. So thank you so much for coming on today in this very horrific weather day. I know it might have been a trial for you, but we appreciate it, Elaine.
Oh, it's not a trial at all. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, well, it's our pleasure. We have many friends there from Pete Valentin, Tim Kalmbach, the Dr. Lee, and now you're the next one in the lineup. And so anyway, with that, as I said, you have many areas of expertise that we could talk about, and an hour goes by quickly. But perhaps you want to start out by telling us a bit about, the real world of forensic science. Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch in terms of what you really deal with on a day-to-day basis, and then maybe we can get into a little bit with regard to cold cases?
Sure. The real world of forensic science is very much like the world of all other scientists in that you spend most of your time in the laboratory conducting analysis, getting data, and interpreting the data. So unlike what you see on TV, we're not out at the scene, and I don't keep my tank top and my high heels in the trunk, so I'm dressed properly. Okay. You spend your time in a lab coat, and the best way you can serve justice is to do a good analysis and interpret that data correctly. So we don't approach anything with a bias. We don't make assumptions about whether people are guilty or innocent. We just do the work. And that is the best way to make to prove the guilt of someone and exonerate the innocent.
Mm-hmm. So it's objective and it's not glamorous. Is that what you're saying?
It's objective and it's definitely not glamorous. We spend a lot of time looking at the people's clothing and bedding and all kinds of things that just are not pretty.
Yeah.
And you have to remain separate from what might have caused the blood stains and what might have caused the damage that you look at every day.
You mean when you talk about remaining separate, you mean keeping your personal perspective out of it?
Keeping your personal perspective out of it and not getting emotionally involved in what you're doing. I mean, as a person, I work a lot with forensic nurses and work with counseling, sexual assault counselors, and understand that this is such a sexual assault is such a vicious crime. But when I'm looking at the evidence, I have to take those personal emotional feelings and lock them away so
mm-hmm.
that they don't affect how I do my work.
Yeah.
And with
the
work that
ahead,
you do and the scientific results that you get, and maybe you know whose case it belongs to or maybe you don't, but what happens to this? I'm assuming that you do a report and your conclusions are written in this report and then it's probably sent to law enforcement. Where does it go from there, and what is the best thing that that particular person or agency can do with that information?
Usually our work is associated with evidence that's submitted from either a police department or a state agency, maybe DCF, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And our results are written in a report form that go back to the submitting agency. If a crime has been committed, then the state's attorney or the district attorney will determine what charges will be made, and then the legal process takes over. Only about 10% of the cases that we examine end up in trial. Most of the cases end up with some kind of plea bargain. That's
mm-hmm.
the standard within the criminal justice system.
What's the percentage, Elaine, of the sort of acute cases that you work on versus cold cases?
Most of the cases that a laboratory works are current cases.
Okay.
They are because the demand for cases going to trial is
right.
great. Most labs are working on those. Cases that need investigative information right away. And
right.
Other current cases, that's primarily what public laboratories work on, because those are the cases that have the greatest possibility of the testing results having a significant impact.
I see. Hmm. And with all your various areas of expertise, which are many, is there one particular area that you feel like you personally can make the most progress? I mean, do you kind of gravitate to the crime scene investigation or the DNA analysis? And I know you teach. And I mean, what do you feel personally in your career where you have made the most inroads, perhaps?
The experience I have in forensic biology, I think.
Can you tell us what that is?
I will, yeah.
Know?
Is very important right now. Forensic
okay.
biology involves testing for the identification of materials, biological materials, stains, and other substances, and the related DNA testing. When I ended my career, I was not working in the laboratory, but was a lab manager. So it has been some years since I've actually done hands-on DNA analysis. But what I find is
the fact that I have the experience of looking at the whole, looking at the big picture, having seen crime scenes, having seen evidence for so long, I do more than just say, okay, here's a stain and let's test it. You say, if someone held a weapon, where would they, how would they hold it to produce the stains that were seen? And then I know where is the most logical place to swab that weapon to try to pick up the DNA of the person who handled it, causing the injury, instead of just following some kind of protocol blindly or something like that. So I think the combination of my crime scene experience and the forensic biology is very helpful. And that's also helpful in cold cases, because many of the cold cases were done before DNA testing was done. So because I'm old, I can look at the report and explain to the current investigators what the testing was, who was eliminated by that testing. Because if you're eliminated by your blood type, DNA testing is not going to include you. So being able to explain that kind of history during current cold case investigation, I think is, I've done a lot of that both for cold cases and in exoneration cases where I've been contacted by Centurion Ministries, for example, who will ask me to look at a report, look at data, and ask for advice in terms of what should be tested or what are the possibilities in a particular case.
It sounds like they may be somewhat similar when you talk about cases where they're looking to exonerate someone and particular cold cases that they, your unit might select. Is that right?
I believe cold case analysis and exoneration case analysis is very similar. In both cases, you have evidence that has to be reexamined with a new eye. What do we have? What can be done with it? What was done with it? And what might it tell us if we do additional testing? And I think that is the same approach you have to take with both a cold case and an exoneration case. The difference, obviously, is with a regular cold case, you may not have any suspect at all, or you may have a suspect but have never been able to include that suspect in the evidence. With an exoneration, you need to prove evidence that would exonerate someone, which is pretty much at the same time finding somebody new who might actually have committed the crime, because it's a very
like
high
process
standard.
Of elimination with the evidence?
Not so much a process of elimination, but in both cases, for example, you would develop a DNA profile of an unknown person. In cold case, you don't know who it is. In a exoneration case, you know it does not match the person who has been convicted.
Okay.
So then you would search that profile against the DNA database and perhaps get what we call a hit, identify a potential source of that DNA in the database.
I see. And, you know, in your biography, you mentioned some of the very high-profile cases that people in Connecticut and New England may be familiar with. And I'm just wondering, were these worked on with regard to cold cases or current with Penny Sierra or Martha Moxley or the Wood Chipper or Michael Ross? I mean, would you want to use one of those as perhaps an illustration?
Sure. The Penny Serra case, for example, would be an example of a case that we worked on as a cold case.
Can you tell our listeners across the nation a little bit about that case first?
Yes, sure. Penny Serra was a young woman who was in a parking garage in the city of New Haven in 1973 and was attacked and found with a knife wound to her chest that caused her death.
Mm-hmm.
There were really no direct witnesses. There were some witnesses who saw somebody in the garage, but really no one who saw the incident. And there was blood in her car, a blood stain on a tissue box in her car.
Mm-hmm.
And those blood stains were in the form of fingerprints. But no one who owned the car, Penny, and no one else matched those fingerprints. No typical suspect, like, they always say, oh, the first one you think about is a boyfriend or a husband,
right?
Somebody like that. The fingerprint did not match any of those people.
And that was in what year? In the 70s, correct?
Yes, in 1973.
Right. Okay.
So forensic science was really just coming into its own at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But for that time, people in the New Haven department had been well trained, and they collected the evidence well and labeled it and had all of the legal requirements for chain of custody, but no leads. And there were actually several suspects in the case. And when I became involved in those cases, there were a couple of suspects, one who was even charged with the case. And when we typed their blood, they were eliminated by their blood type.
Okay.
So for more than 20 years, that case was reexamined periodically. Well,
oh, okay.
It didn't sit, but you couldn't spend a lot of time on it because you had continuing cases.
Sure.
So periodically, it would be examined when a new technique was developed. We would do testing on that to try to compare it to known persons. The fingerprint was periodically checked by the New Haven Police Department as people were arrested. And in fact, three of the officers who worked on the case actually came to work at the lab. And they would continue to search that fingerprint among the fingerprints of the suspects in other cases.
Okay.
In 1997, so almost 25 years later, one of our fingerprint examiners searched the fingerprint database and found a match to the fingerprint, the bloody fingerprint on the tissue box, and
mm-hmm.
identified a suspect through that fingerprint.
Wow, after 25 years, how exciting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they had to go back then, and investigators had to go back, find out if that person was in the area, if where he was, what he was doing. Ultimately, they got a blood sample. And
mm-hmm.
when we did that, testing on another item of evidence, actually, we got 13 places on the DNA, what we call loci, 13 places on the DNA that matched the suspect. So when the case
wow.
came to trial in 2000, there was a fingerprint match and a DNA match. And there was no way this person would have been associated with the Penny Serra case in any other way. He was not from New Haven. He didn't know her. To this day, there's no indication of motive.
Mm-hmm.
But you had physical evidence that
right.
led to the identification of a suspect and ultimately his conviction.
Now, was his fingerprint in the database for all that time and it was just a matter of finding it?
No, his fingerprint was not in the database, and that's
okay.
One of the issues with databases. His fingerprint was not in the database until a few months earlier when he was arrested for a totally unrelated incident. And they took his fingerprints, and then eventually they were put into the state database.
Right.
And then once they were in the state database, the next search, which is usually once a month, the next search of the cold case hit on that fingerprint. So databases are only as good as the information that's in them. So
that constantly update them, Elaine? Is that part of their job to constantly be just inputting data?
Well, different states work slightly differently. But for fingerprints, usually the fingerprints are added into the state databases as part of a routine. You know, now that fingerprints are electronic, and they do an electronic scan, they actually get in there much faster.
Okay.
A DNA database works similarly. We get known samples from, in Connecticut, convicted offenders and some people who are arrested for crimes. And in other states, people who are arrested for any felony might also have to give a sample. It depends on the state what the law is, but
mm-hmm.
every state at least collects samples from convicted felons. Those samples have to be checked. The DNA has to be removed. The profile has to be developed. An examiner has to check the profile to make sure that it meets the standards that have been set up, and then it's put into the database.
Wow, sounds like a fairly long process.
Pardon?
It sounds like a very fairly long process.
Well, it isn't a long process, but we want to make sure that the data that goes into the database is accurate.
Yes.
So each sample has to be checked for correct interpretation, and then the results, the profile, go into the database, and they also go into the national database, into CODIS,
right.
And that is run by the FBI, and that information is available to every single state and territory of the United States that has a DNA laboratory.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a wonderful resource, and we also are familiar with NamUs as well. But just so that we know the end of the story with Penny Sarah, how did the perpetrator get connected with Penny? I mean, what relationship was there at all? Was there anything established?
Absolutely none.
No.
So it's just a random crime.
It appears to have been some kind of a random crime. He was in the area of the state that day. They were able to confirm that
mm-hmm.
since he was from another part of the state. But other than that, they have never established any kind of personal association or motive to the crime. So the conviction in the jury's mind was actually all based on the scientific evidence.
Right. And wasn't it a shame that wasn't her dad ultimately passed away before they got that knowledge?
Her father was very good. He called every month just to make sure people did not forget. And when I was acting as director of the laboratory, I spoke with him right about the time that the identification was made, and I told him that I could not give him the details or the names, but that he should know very shortly that the there had been somebody identified based on the fingerprint and the DNA, and that he would
wow.
he would know of that. So he was aware that someone
mm-hmm.
had been identified, but he was not living when that person was arrested.
Well, at least he had that knowledge, you know, that's very good. And Delilah, didn't you have some questions with regard to backlogs of DNA and some procedural things?
I do, and, you know, again, coming to you from a layman's point of view, and maybe you can enlighten other listeners who don't have quite the background knowledge. You know, there's a big issue all across the country right now in the backlog of rape kits. And I guess my question to you as a scientist, an expert in DNA, if you could just quickly walk us through the process of what happens, how long does it take, how much does it cost to process these rape kits, and why do we have such a huge backlog? Is this something that is just inexplainable, or is there really valid reasons for hundreds of thousands of these to be laying on shelves and it taken 20 years to match them up or, you know, find the actual perpetrator who's been out 20 years committing more crime?
Right. Yes, I can understand. I can understand the concern, and there really are a lot of reasons why I think there are unanalyzed sex crimes kits on the shelves in various locations. I think one reason is some kits are not examined because they're for a long time there was no way to identify who could have committed the crime.
Mm-hmm.
So if the police start investigating and the survivor does not know who assaulted them, and it was not a known person, for many years until DNA, there was no way to associate the biological material that might be present to anyone.
So okay, so maybe that's 50% of the cases right there, or who knows?
No, it's not that many. But I think for the I don't know exactly what the percentage is, and I wouldn't guess. But for
okay.
those cases, they sat on the shelf. Once DNA became testing became relatively fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we first started doing DNA, we would have to wait 3 months to get a result. And you would need a lot of DNA to get a good result. So once DNA became a faster process, a lot of places, and the database was established,
mm-hmm.
then laboratories started looking at those what we call no suspect cases, because we now had a way to identify potentially who might have deposited the biological material. So
mm-hmm.
that's one set of cases. And the older cases, once they were past what was the old statute of limitations, which is the time after which you cannot charge someone with the crime, the kits just sat there. Now,
and does that vary from state to state, Elaine?
That also varies from state to state. Now, what a lot of states have done is, again, what Connecticut has done, if there's DNA in a case, there is no statute of limitations. So the sexual assault cases are examined to determine if there is a DNA profile, so
mm-hmm.
that if we don't identify that person for 20 years, we had the DNA and now we can charge that person.
Well, that's good.
So,
is that typical for many states, or are we unique
yes,
to that?
Well, it is now. Many states have that or a similar type of law where that's the instance.
Okay.
Another problem with sex crimes kits is they actually have a lot of evidence in them. And each item has to be examined. So the kit, typical kit will have 20 different items in it. It will have swabs and smears and hairs and fingernails and all kinds of different materials that have been taken during the examination of the survivor of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Each item must be looked at. So if you're looking for semen, each item has to be tested for semen. If it looks like semen may be present, then a laboratory examiner will actually look for sperm, which is takes time. It takes probably an hour to look at one glass slide to see if there's sperm on it. So if you have six swabs, you have a minimum of three glass slides you have to look at. Then those then must go to DNA. And DNA then must take the DNA out, copy it, analyze it, and that, again, will take probably a minimum of 6 days to do that test. So you're talking, if we do the major evidence within that kit, assuming it's all positive, that's five items times all of that time.
Right.
And then it just... everything builds up, because meanwhile, you also have all of the items from all of the major cases like homicides, assaults, and then you have all of the evidence from property cases as well, that there's a big push to do those as well.
So while most simultaneously. Yeah, you're not working on one case at a time like they do in CSI and they say, oh, yeah, I'm going to follow this through until the end. You're working on many things at the same time, correct?
That's correct. And each case is in a different stage of its development.
Mm-hmm.
Then when everything is done, then everything has to be reviewed by another examiner. For quality assurance and to make sure everything was done correctly. So you're actually tying up two persons on each case to review the evidence and determine what the results are.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
The influx of requests for DNA, once we were able to get a decent readable profile from small amounts of sample, just skyrocketed. So you have a section that has maybe five people in it.
Yeah.
So if they can do 10 cases a month, that's still only 50 cases a month that they can accomplish out of the thousands of cases that are submitted every year.
Wow. Just incredible, the volume.
Right. So, money is very tight. So with fewer resources, you cannot hire as many people. Some states have gotten grant money, and they've been able to expand their units. But it's a constant fight for resources. And DNA
testing is money and resources and more people to process the kit. Is that the answer to this? Because I know there is no pat answer, I'm sure. But
right.
What is going to help? What is it that's going to help the most to get caught up on these so that more of these perpetrators are caught before they can, like I say, they're out there committing other heinous crimes. So what do we do?
I think this is certainly my opinion, but in my opinion, I think you have to take a multi-prong approach. One is to hire more people who are well-trained. One is to use automation as much as possible. You can buy robotic instruments that you can just set it up, and then the robot will do the routine, adding liquid, taking it out, putting it in, doing the next stage. There are new instruments available now that have just been released where you can develop a DNA profile in 90 minutes. And those need to be... As opposed to three days.
Okay.
Wow.
So those need to be tested and validated on case material. They're being pushed right now for known samples. So if you get a suspect, you could take a swab, put it in there, and tell in, you know, 2 hours whether his profile is similar to a profile that's been obtained. So I think those instruments need to be validated for use with real evidence.
Wow, well, could and you get a grant to do robotics? I mean, to get a robot to do some of the quote-unquote mundane things?
Yes, there has been a money available from the federal government through the DNA initiative that was started by President Bush. And every year, based on the number of cases that go through a state, there is money available to buy equipment, to hire temporary personnel, to do whatever a particular laboratory feels is the best way to deal with this DNA backlog.
And who's the deciding factor, Elaine, at your facility with regard to that? Yeah, we're going to use the money this way, or is it a committee of people that decide?
It differs from lab to lab. It's usually, however, the DNA unit. The DNA unit will determine what would increase the productivity. And where the backup is. In some laboratories, the backup may be in the actual examination of the kits themselves. So they need more people who are trained to actually go through the kit, look at it, find the positive samples, and then get those to the DNA robot. In another lab, it might be that stage is done, but the samples are waiting for DNA analysis. So it depends on the laboratory where that backup may be. So the lab would be the best place to decide where we're going to spend the money.
And you have input into that? I mean, it sounds like a good plan.
Well, I did have input when I was at the laboratory. We do talk about these things at meetings. And we are actually in the process of writing a grant proposal, hoping to get one of those rapid DNA instruments so that we can conduct some of that validation testing and sort of help the process along and say, look, this is work that we have done so that you can see this might be a useful thing for you to use. It is very expensive at the moment to use. While the instrument is not that expensive, it's only $250,000, which, as instruments go, is probably middle cost. But each test is very expensive to run currently on that instrument. You can do five tests for $1,200, and two of those have to be controls. So three tests for $1,200 is a lot of money. But I think the more people use this, the more the price will go down. Because right now they're recouping development costs and and things like that, where as there's more demand, the price will go down. That's what happened previously with other DNA procedures.
Well, how do you prioritize in terms of which cases get to be analyzed? Is it a matter of when the crime occurred, or if it's more high profile, or if someone is asking about this case more than the next case, or how does that go?
That's a very good question. And I think I always felt it was a lot like juggling.
Okay.
Because you have to keep several balls in the air at one time when you do case work. So the cases that obviously will get top priority are those cases that the trial is starting next month and you have to finish the work. Because the criminal justice process is at a stage where, okay, time has run out, you need the data. But at the same time, equally demanding are those cases that are brand new and they need some investigative leads to identify a suspect, or to they have blood on a suspect's shirt and they want us to match it to the victim so they can make an arrest. So those are also equally demanding. And then you have cases that you can't make any identification until you get the DNA done, like the no suspect DNA cases. So you're constantly tossing those kinds of cases around in the air, and every once in a while they throw in another ball, which is the the burglary where the perpetrator left the blood on the window, and so you do that. And then if you're really good, I guess you can juggle five balls. And so the fifth one are the exoneration cases and cold cases where, okay, this is kind of old, but could you, like, get this done because we think we have somebody in jail who shouldn't be there. We don't want that to last any longer than possible. So
well, it's kind of like being at the deli. You pick one from one category, one from another one. I mean, I don't know.
Like I said, it's like juggling, and you're constantly shifting priorities as different cases come in and make demands. So it's not something you can say, okay, we always do this kind of case first. So, for example, we'll say, all right, I'm working on this case, and then a child sexual assault case comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So with the child sexual assault case, that child can't take care of him or herself. You have to get that done so they can find out if they have to remove that child from wherever the child is.
Okay,
if
so that
it happens
goes to
be a relative. So then that may go to the top of the pile. So there's this constant rearranging and juggling of what has priority.
Yeah. Well, I know that when I was listening to our other show with Tim, and he was saying how, you know, there's about 500 programs across the country, and the Henry Lee Institute certainly is up there in the top rung, and there's a certain percentage of people, of students that go there from medical school. Is it a matter of, you know, if you lack sufficient staff to do these types of things, are you projecting into the future, number one, that you need more people doing forensics, so maybe by whatever means you have, you might steer people from, you know, not going into pathology, but then doing this? And then the other area that he was really concerned about was that, what if we had this massive crime spree of huge proportion, and that we're just not ready for it with the manpower or person power? What would you have to say about that?
Well, there are a very large number of people who are studying forensic science at this time in accredited graduate programs, such as the one at the University of New Haven, where I work. Mm-hmm. And these students are very capable. Yes, they're entry level for the most part. Most of them do not have experience, but they might have other lab experience, but they're well trained. So they can relatively quickly start working on casework. They're all looking for jobs right now, and the jobs are not as numerous as you would expect because state budgets are tight. There just is not as the money available for the number of positions that the laboratories might require. So mm-hmm. they have to say, all right, we really need 10 people, but we only have the money to hire 5. So you hire 5 people,
mm-hmm.
hoping that next year there might be money in the budget to hire a couple more, or there might be some grant money. So I think there are a lot of people who are coming out well qualified to start their careers, but the laboratories don't have the resources to hire these people.
So what do they do in the interim?
Well, I think we have to concentrate on the automated systems,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things.
Right.
I think the other thing we have to do is educate prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, and explain to them, if I have swabs from a sex crimes kit that's directly taken from the victim of a sexual assault, I don't have to look at the clothing and the bedding and everything else that's been submitted. And what has happened is, in the past, we could say, okay, we found this, this is the best evidence, and not look at the other things. Now people are saying, no, you have to look at everything. So I think part of what we can do is educate the bar,
mm-hmm.
and say, we don't need to look at all of the evidence.
Right.
If we find an association, that should be enough. If you're the defense attorney and you want something else looked at and it's scientifically reasonable, most laboratories will agree. But if it's something you just want to do because maybe there'll be something there, well, you have to find a way to take that evidence and get that tested.
Right, you prioritize, and doesn't it become a matter of storage, too? I mean, you can only store so much evidence with all these cases, I would imagine.
Well, the laboratories at the end give all the evidence back. We only save pieces of the evidence. We save the samples that we've cut out or retained. So it is something, storage is an issue, but not as much for a lab. And studies have shown that the best storage for biological material is actually room temperature in a controlled environment. So since most buildings now are air conditioned, we can actually store our materials in an air conditioned room, and that's a good long-term storage for those materials. So storage is not as much of an issue anymore.
Okay, well, that's good. And with respect to when I was saying, well, what do we do with those entry-level people that are well-trained but yet there aren't positions, I was wondering about what do those students do in the interim? Are they working at McDonald's until a job comes up? Or, you know, are you able to utilize them in a different way?
Some of them are volunteering. Near their home at laboratories. They obviously cannot do casework as a volunteer because there might be legal issues with that. But they can help with the other jobs that, you could show that they're trained. They can help with even, typing reports into the computer or filing or all of those things that you don't even think about, but everybody has at their job that takes time.
Right.
So if I have to go and file 25 files,
mm-hmm.
then that's going to take a certain amount of time. But if I can give that to a volunteer, that hour that I'm going to spend doing the filing, now I can spend doing cases. Mm-hmm. So some of the students actually do volunteer work in a related laboratory. Some of them take jobs to hone their skills. So, for example, last year somebody took a job in a medical research lab mm-hmm. where she was doing DNA research. So she was using the same techniques that you would use in a forensic lab. And then after she worked there for about 8 months, she got a job in a forensic laboratory.
Oh, wow.
So,
well,
so
I was
going to
say, when I leave my job, I'll come down and volunteer. Is that okay?
Sure.
I would love to. But anyway, I'm sorry. I injected a little humor there. I'm serious, though. I'd love to. That's great. You know, another thing that your colleagues made reference to is that in this whole issue of staying current with what's on the fore and with decreasing resources is that academia has to get more involved. And I know you teach as well. We have about 8 minutes left of the show, Elaine. And this is flying by too quickly here. But can you tell us something of your teaching experience and what do you think is the most important with respect to addressing, you know, what students need to know, what they come prepared for, what you think is the most important in terms of teaching, and how can they help with these backlogs and what Delilah was talking about in terms of, you know, the heaping amounts of work?
Well, that's a good question. I love teaching. It's something that I have done actually since I graduated from college, and I very much enjoy that. I think the universities are very important. It's very important to have former practitioners and current practitioners on your faculty. If you have people who actually have done forensic casework, and I don't mean sort of as a consultant, but someone who's been in a laboratory,
mm-hmm.
understands how a functioning forensic laboratory works, what the challenges are, how people have to address the evidence, what the evidence is like. It's not,
right.
you know, these pristine samples, but it's here's another problem, how do we solve it kinds of samples.
Yeah.
That you're aware of the multitasking that people have to do. I think that is one thing that academia can really do to prepare students better for what they will face in a forensic lab. And the better prepared they are, the
mm-hmm.
better they can handle evidence, the better they can work and come up with some of these new ideas of what we can do. I know for many years at our laboratory, we did a lot of what I used to call practical research. We would encounter an issue, and then we would work out a procedure or a plan to solve those issues. So if we only had one small blood stain, how do we do all the testing that we want to do on that one small stain?
Mm-hmm.
That we worked out in our lab and then presented it at academic programs and at professional meetings, and then everybody was aware that that was a possible way to approach the problem if you had only a small stain. So So I think academia
I imagine
can,
you have to think out of the box a lot in terms of, you know, dealing with just very limited samples then.
Right, right. And it had to be validated. And I think that's what academia can also do. They can also help with solving some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the newer techniques for analyzing compromised DNA samples, for example, came out of the tragedy of 9/11. Because they had to have ways to identify the remains that were being identified after the buildings collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And both private laboratories and the public laboratory worked together to try to solve some of these issues. They also had people in academia working on new testing methods that could be applied. So I think that cooperation between academia and the public labs is also very important. So that's the thing that can help. And one of the classes that I teach, I actually teach two classes that are somewhat related. In the forensic department, I teach a course on how to be a successful expert witness. And they call it expert testimony, but that's not really what we talk about. We talk about what are your professional responsibilities as a scientific expert. And at the law school, I teach the future lawyers about forensic science.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And if more attorneys who are involved in criminal law and litigation knew about forensics, that would also help.
Oh, definitely. We all know that one. And, you know, before we have to sign off, can you tell us about your contact information in case anyone would like to keep up with what's being done, or perhaps if they're in the area they want a tour or have a general question that we might be able to funnel to you or whatever?
Sure. My contact information, the best way to get in touch with me is at the University of New Haven.
Yeah.
And they can either email me directly at epagliaro@newhaven.edu, or they can actually get on the Henry Seeley Institute of Forensic Science website, and there's a place to submit an inquiry. And they can leave their contact information and their inquiry on the Institute website, and it will be forwarded to me.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that's good. We have a direct pipeline. And would you consider coming back and talking to us further in the future?
Well, I'd love to come back if you think you'd
definitely.
Like to have me again. So.
I think it would, and we'll be in contact. And in the meantime, I'd like everyone to please visit DonnaGore.com and ImaginePublicity.com, and please go to our websites and learn about the topics and share with us every week on Shattered Lives, and we look forward to it. And I want to thank you again, Elaine, and I'll talk to you off air. And Delilah, thank you so much. So everyone, have a good evening. Be safe, and thank you so much. And we'll talk to you next week. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine.